The show is live and local. It's your connection to local music and more. And today, actually, not really about local music, except for the sort of far-reaching implications of some of what we're going to talk about, which are some of the norms of audience behavior specific to England, specific to London, specific to West End London, and specific to the early part of the 19th century. But all of that will be interesting contrast, and some of it not so contrasting with some of the norms now. Anyway, should be a nice discussion with Christina Bashford. She is assistant professor of musicology at the University of Illinois School of Music, and I'm looking forward to the hour. And we'll have lots of music as well, including this by Franz Joseph Haydn from his 104th symphony. Well, there's a nice little taste of the opening movement of the 104th Symphony, which is the last, officially the last symphony of Joseph Haydn, a performance here by the London Classical Players, conducted by Roger Norrington, and that group entirely appropriate since we're at least going to start our conversation on Live and Local today around the city of London, early Victorian London, and audiences for various types of music, but particularly chamber music, and implications for today, sort of. My guest is Christina Bashford, who teaches musicology at the University of Illinois School of Music. Thank you, Christina, very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And you have made this a sort of the general social issues of music and a special interest of yours.
That's
cultural
right.
Behaviors and things like that.
Uh-huh.
What got you interested in that sort of thing
in
particular?
Yeah. I think it was Oscar Wilde said something like that all criticism is autobiography, in the sense that we all choose our topics in terms of things that interest us and have special meaning for us. And I suppose for me, this topic sort of came out of where I was at a particular time. In other words, I was living in London. I was a student. I was a graduate student at the University of London. And one of the things I'd always done a lot of as a student was play a lot of chamber music. I loved it. And when I was in London, I started going to concerts like one does. And I spent a lot of time at the Wigmore Hall, which is the principal chamber music venue in London, and just loved it. But I got very interested at that time about why we were doing what we did. Why did we sit in silence? Why did we sit in rows? Why did people come onto the platform wearing 19th century dress? Basically, where had all this begun? And maybe there was a topic there for me, and that's what started it. So it was a sort of musical curiosity to do with my love of chamber music and where I was at the time. And that got me all the way back to about the 1830s, and in some respects a bit earlier too.
So is this topic of audience behavior, was that kind of the start of where you've since branched out into lots of other kinds of cultural
music? It was just one aspect of it. I mean, I was interested in performance history as well. I mean, what was being played? How was it being played? But one of the things I got on top of quite quickly was this question of the audience, because the whole idea of the concert, actually, even in 1830, was pretty new. I mean, we've only had concerts around since the late 18th century in terms of public events. So there was a lot to be done, and there was a lot to be sorted out in terms of how people were going to behave themselves when they went into a concert room.
So up to that point, instead of concerts, we had what?
Well, we would have had concerts in private venues and in so aristocratic palaces. Those were the places where you might have had concerts. But the idea of people actually paying money to go to music, that's sort of 1760s, 1770s. That's where the concert sort of begins. It begins in London also, and it's also pretty prolific in Vienna and Paris. Otherwise, people were making music in their own homes. Yep.
And you are and were a violinist.
Mm-hmm.
Which was where you got your chamber music start.
That's right. So I was playing a lot of string quartets, and that's how this curiosity developed, really.
Well, and many people at the time played something.
Right. And a lot of people played, a lot of people in the 19th century, of course, played the piano. I mean, that was the principal instrument. And we talk a lot in Victorian terms of piano culture, in the sense that that was the instrument that everybody knew. In the 18th century, and to some extent still through the 19th, people also played stringed instruments, particularly people with enough wealth to own an instrument and have lessons and so forth. Because what we're talking about here, when we talk about a concert audience, of course, is a pretty wealthy, well-heeled mass of people, at least until the later 19th century, when concert going gets opened up further down the middle classes and even into the working classes.
So in the article that is kind of our starting point today, which I'm looking at right here, Learning to Listen, Audiences for Chamber Music in Early Victorian London. This is from... What journal is this from? My copy doesn't say.
It's from the Journal of Victorian Culture, appropriately enough.
And you take as your jumping off point two particular chamber music societies in a particular part of London.
Right, I do. That's right.
Why that part of London?
Why the West End? Oh, well, yeah. Haha. Okay, so in 1830, London was a much, much smaller city than it is today. And the West End was where most of the world of fashion lived and played. I mean, when I say play, I mean play. It sort of had its entertainment. London basically divided into two. There was the West End, which was the more residential district. There was the City of London, the old city, where the commercial district was located and where all the banking and commerce took place. Most people lived in the West End. People who went to concerts tended to go to concerts in the West End. That's where Haydn went when he came to London in the 1790s and wrote that symphony we've just heard.
That's where he went to stay?
He went to stay. Yeah. He came twice, or he went twice, I should say. I'm not in London anymore, am I?
No, you're not.
No, I'm not.
You're in Urbana.
He went twice in the 1790s and wrote 12 symphonies for London. And that was the last of the set that we heard.
What prompted the formation of these particular chamber music societies? Why did these guys who started them feel it was necessary?
These two societies we've been talking about came out of a broader trend towards chamber music performance, which had begun in the 1830s. So there was a lot of people out there trying to put on concerts and trying to put on concerts of chamber music because economically those were pretty sound. You didn't need many players. It's not like hiring an orchestra. And so the economics of it tended to work much better. There was a lot of music. Think of all those Haydn quartets, Beethoven quartets, Mozart quartets, piano trios, etc., etc. Marvelous sort of stock of music to be heard. And basically, musicians were putting on concerts quite frequently. Now, within that context, then, there were two societies which came out of it. One was called the Musical Union, and one was called the Beethoven Quartet Society.
And they differed in what way?
Well, they differed...
Multiple ways, I guess.
Many ways. The Beethoven Quartet Society is an interesting one. It was a small society. It was a society mainly for professional musicians or really, really serious music lovers.
The Beethoven one.
The Beethoven one.
And Beethoven worshippers.
And Beethoven worshippers, absolutely. It was set up specifically to have an entire cycle of the Beethoven quartets performed each year, each season, which is actually a pretty modern idea, right? It's quite extraordinary, I think, to find that people were actually doing that in 1845, which is when that society began.
And Beethoven was only dead for about 18 years at that point.
Yeah, I mean, it's very, very new music and some of it very, very difficult music for audiences, of course. But anyway, so the Beethoven Quartet Society was probably a group of about 50 to 100 people. It wasn't big, but it got a lot of attention, partly because of this incredibly earnest devotion to Beethoven, almost religious-like reverence for the quartets. And they met, I suppose, five or six times a season, and they had three quartets in each concert, an early period quartet, so one of the Opus 18, a middle period quartet, typically one of the Opus 59, and then one of the late period quartets, which were terrifically difficult both to play and to comprehend.
And still are.
And still are, yeah. But the idea being that by juxtaposing these three pieces, or at least listening to them in sequence, in fact, one could actually trace the connections and the development of the composer's style. And again, that's a very, very modern idea for 1845. If you start to think about it, there aren't many other composers that sort of thing's been tried for.
Right. The Musical Union, in contrast, was
a rather different organization, much bigger. 500, 600 subscribers. Most of the economics of this sort of concert giving at the time were basically through subscription. Musical Union was a group of wealthy, middle-class, aristocratic music lovers. They were serious-minded people, but they weren't people who came with a vast knowledge of music necessarily, or at least not a vast technical knowledge of music. And the idea behind the Musical Union was one of education, trying to get people to understand and appreciate this incredible body of music. And of course, it wasn't just Beethoven, although Beethoven was central. There was Mozart, there was Haydn, there was Mendelssohn, Schumann, etc.
Onslow.
George Onslow as well, yes.
Not exactly a household name today, but...
But he was, yes.
Not well up there.
That's right, yeah. George Onslow, a sort of French-English composer who wrote a lot of string quartets and a lot of string quintets, which were very popular with amateurs. String quintets with two cellos, typically. There's lots and lots of them, quite lyrical pieces. Some of them have been recorded. They're not very often done. They're pretty pleasant enough.
Yeah, I know we have some of them here at the station. Uh-huh. We should try some sometime. The fellow who organized the Musical Union, John Ella, was that his name?
John Ella, yes.
He had not only the mission, it seems, of bringing the music to these people, and, you know, sort of mutual appreciation society, but also of trying to teach them how to behave.
Right. How to behave, because, yeah, if you're going to listen well, you have to behave well. I mean, if you think about it, and you have to be quiet if you're going to listen well, right?
So what was he combating at this point? What were the norms?
The norms that he was combating, oh, and some of them will make you smile because, in a sense, we're still combating
Nothing's
them today.
Changed.
Well, I think it did change for a while, but I think we maybe in some ways we've slipped back. All sorts of things. The principal one being the need for silence. I mean, silence was not necessarily something you took for granted in a London concert, and that was true going back to Haydn's day. And so one of the first things John Ella wanted to do was to insist that people were quiet when they were in the concert room. That meant making sure that people didn't come and go during pieces of music. Yes. I mean, one thing you have to remember here is that the doors didn't tend to shut in the way that they do today at a concert when the music begins. So people could come and go all the time, and there would be a lot of disruption because of that. And people were used to that. People, in fact, were used to going to concerts not necessarily on time. Yeah, turning up late was perfectly acceptable.
And leaving early.
And one of the things Ella did was actually cut down the length of the concert to something that we would recognize as being concert length today, like three pieces of music, yeah? Three string quartets or two string quartets and a piano trio. But the norm that Ella was working against was one of long concerts, maybe 3 hours worth of music.
Or more.
Yeah. A concert divided into two halves of equal length. Maybe, say, in a chamber music concert, you might have a quartet. Then you would have maybe an aria sung by an opera singer who'd come along to do that. Then we might have a piano trio. Then we might have another vocal item. Then we might have another string quartet. And then we would have the intermission.
Food.
Or interval, as we call it in England. And then and that was part one, or act one. And then in the second half, you'd do the same all over again. So the whole thing could go on well into the night if it was an evening concert.
But people popping in and out and making commentary, you know, what are the sort of noises that would be made?
The noises. Well, people would talk. I mean, people wouldn't necessarily be quiet, even necessarily think to be quiet when the music started. I mean, that's one of the things that perhaps is still somewhat surprising to us, right? But there's actually a really nice passage in one of Fanny Burney's novels which describes this quite well. And I brought it along if you're going to let me read it.
I'll let you read it.
Let
sure.
me read it. Because it actually makes this point that in a sense, music is secondary to the social aspect of the concert event. So this is from her novel, Cecilia, of 1782. And it's an account of the Pantheon concerts in London. And this is very much the atmosphere that Haydn would have encountered when he arrived. Okay, the passage goes like this. They entered the great room during the second act of the concert, to which, as no one of the party but herself had any desire to listen, no sort of attention was paid. The ladies entertaining themselves as if no orchestra was in the room, and the gentlemen, with an equal disregard to it, struggling for a place by the fire, about which they continued hovering till the music was over.
So clearly they were there to hang out with each other and music happened to be going on.
Right, music as background, yeah. And so what's happening in these chamber music concerts we're talking about is a complete shift from that to making the music the absolute central point.
Since you said that this is the sort of thing Haydn did encounter when he got there, and you chose a particular Haydn symphony to mm-hmm. kind of illustrate his attack on this sort of behavior?
Supposedly, or allegedly. Well, maybe the 94th symphony is nicknamed the surprise because of a certain little surprise that happens in its second movement. So,
do we want to hear it?
But, and then we could talk about it.
Maybe. We can hear it and then give the perhaps apocryphal, perhaps not, story around it. Yeah. All right. Christina Bashford, my guest here on Live and Local. I'm Kevin Kelly, and this is the second movement of Haydn's 94th Symphony. In this case, we're hearing the Hanover Band, directed by Roy Goodman. Well, we've had the surprise in that nicknamed Surprise Symphony of Haydn's. As usual, it wasn't the nickname he gave it. It was a symphony number 94, but probably pretty obvious why it got called that, this performance by the Hanover Band led by Roy Goodman. But the question is, why did he do that?
Why did he do
this
that?
This big loud crash after the nice, sedate, quiet music.
Movement. Yeah, it's a theme and variations movement. In fact, the big loud crash doesn't reoccur in the variations, which is sort of interesting. So it only happens at that one point at the opening of the theme. Well, why did he do it? There are various stories. And the story the program note writers always love is the idea that Haydn apparently said that he did it to wake up some of those ladies at his concerts who were sleeping through the music. So obviously at these concerts, not everybody talked. Some people apparently could even sleep.
In spite of the talking.
In spite of the talking, which is interesting, isn't it? So that's the story. And there are various sort of contemporary sources that sort of support it, but it's all anecdotal. What cuts against that is that Haydn apparently was asked by his biographer in, I think it's sort of 1800-something or other, just before Haydn died. His biographer asked him about this, and he denied it. So we don't really know. I mean, in Haydn's own words, no, it wasn't intended, but some sources say it was. Certainly, it's typical of a lot of the humour that we find in Haydn's music.
Yeah. Of which there is plenty.
Plenty.
Yeah, but that's one of the more blatant. I mean, it makes a good story.
It makes a good story, and it makes the same point, actually, that if people were sleeping or if they were talking, they certainly weren't listening to the music. So there was work to be done by people like John Eller.
Some of the talking that was going on was actually appreciative talking, or at least some of the activity that was going on. You know,
it
when do you applaud
been.
And when do you don't, which,
oh,
is,
yeah, there's
which
that.
Is an issue that people deal with today.
Yeah, yes, when to applaud. Oh, well, let's talk about that because that's an interesting one. The convention, certainly in London at this time, and probably through most of the 19th century, the convention was to applaud each movement as it happened. So we didn't so people didn't wait to the end, as we do now, to applaud a four movement string quartet or symphony. People would applaud at the end of each movement. Now, I know now if we go to a concert and somebody starts to applaud in between movements, they probably get a rather snooty look
from
people around them. But no, in the 19th century, it was fine. You showed your appreciation. Now, this actually extended further to the fact that if a movement was particularly well liked, yeah, people would shout out encore as well, and that movement would be replayed in sequence before going on to the next.
So our encore today is really an entirely different
thing. Different practice, that's right. And when it changed, I'm not entirely sure, but I think it was much later. And so for much of the 19th century, people were doing this thing where, particularly with scherzos, I think scherzos got encored quite frequently.
They're fast and lively and fun.
Let's hear that again. Exactly. And so that would happen. And of course, underneath that, there's a bigger point, which is that, you know, people weren't respecting the unity of the composition, which we have come to do in modern days. And that's why people will get so cross when people applaud between movements, because they're disrupting the continuity of the piece and so on. That wasn't a concern for them in the 19th century.
In a way, we're going back. Mm-hmm. In some venues, yes. There's certainly movement to go back to that. And instead of shushing people,
right,
you know, well, if you appreciate it,
sure,
let people know. I mean, if you go to a rock concert, people are going to applaud
right.
whenever they want.
Right.
If you go to a
right.
jazz concert, routinely, it's sure. somebody does a solo, the music keeps going, you
right.
applaud in the middle
right.
of the music.
Yeah. And I mean, certainly two things. One is that John Eller was not averse to people applauding between movements. I mean, he wasn't trying to stop that. And I think he was also quite okay about the idea that, you know, a response from the audience was a good thing. So some sort of murmuring maybe at a really nice moment of phrasing or a particularly juicy piece of harmony that was brought out particularly well, that was okay. And that actually implied a sort of connoisseurship, because you were actually appreciating the finer points of the music.
Well, I'm looking at this quotation you have in your article, where it says, profound silence is observed, except that indescribable murmur of applause. It's some delicate trait in the execution, and I like this next part, which never interrupts but encourages the executants.
Absolutely.
Which is very much like jazz.
Yeah, very much like the modern jazz environment. And I mean, what's interesting with all of this is, one thing that actually Eller did, we haven't said this, but I should say this, with his chamber music concerts, was that he put the string quartet or the piano trio or whatever, or the group of performers anyway, in the center of the concert hall. They weren't at one end. They were right in the middle, and the audience was set around on all four sides, so that the audience was actually communing with the players and through the players with the music and effectively the composer. So everybody was sort of joined together in spirit. And I suppose that's one of the reasons the term musical union is a great one for it, because it was a union of everybody, actually, in the listening and performing experience. I've actually tried reconstructing this with players in England, and with one group. We actually did a whole musical union concert with a group of players who were up for this as an experiment. And we sat everyone around the string quartet. And it was pretty nice, although the players sometimes complain that they feel a little self-conscious because they've got people actually looking into their backs. And I think actually even in the 19th century, sometimes performers got a bit uncomfortable with it. But it was a very special type of environment. And I love it as a listener. I just love being in the round with chamber music. It's fantastic.
Well, I can imagine. I've watched, when we do live shows here on Live and Local,
yeah,
in our studio, and you've got people right in front of me, and I'm thinking, you know, they're all sitting watching, aware that I'm staring at them.
Yeah.
Not intentionally to be rude, but
It's very intense.
It is intense, and, you know, if you're looking over their shoulder
right.
and are knowledgeable, you could
Follow the music
and say, ooh, he just made a mistake.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons that some performers, both now and then, were a little uncomfortable with it. Though having said that, with what Eller did with the musical union was actually to create a little bit more distance. He put his players, particularly in St. James's Hall, which was a big venue, he put the players on a podium which he covered with a red crimson carpet. And so the players were actually elevated a little bit above the audience. And there were, I think there was a little bit of distance from the first row of seats, because clearly it could be very, very uncomfortable.
What were some of the his other innovations or warnings? He put some stern reminders in the program.
Yeah, he was forever printing, silence must be observed at all times, et cetera, et cetera, and that people are not to come and go during the performance. Once you're sat down, you are sat down, and you're not to come in either, and disrupt anything. What else did he do? Well, actually, I suppose his principal innovation was the invention, just about, of the program note. Yeah, something we take for granted today. Yeah, we go into a concert, we're handed a program note. That wasn't always the case. When Haydn came to London, there were no program notes. But John Eller pretty much started the phenomenon in England. And in fact, the phenomenon began in England far earlier than it took up in other countries, partly because I think London's concert life was so extensive and so developed. Anyway, Eller wrote program notes for each of the pieces in his concerts, and they were very unusual. Well, they look very unusual to the modern day reader, because they actually include the principal themes of each piece printed in musical notation in the program, which, when you look at an older program note from England, this is really quite extraordinary. I mean, can you imagine that in a Cranach program today?
Well, maybe not a Cranach program, but I seem to remember at the Chicago Symphony programs when I was in college.
Maybe.
One of my mentors there, Aaron Parsons, who was one of your counterparts at Northwestern, he would put some of those in there.
Yeah. Certainly the practice continued into the 20th century in Britain with the Halle Orchestra. They were doing it still, I think, even into the 1960s or 70s, maybe even a little later. It's sort of costly, because you have to print, then you had to set up musical type. But in the 19th century, certainly at very serious concerts, it became the norm to print the themes. And the idea being that you spell out the musical material so that people can then follow its treatment and development within the string quartet or symphony or whatever they're listening to.
Didn't he also send these out ahead of time? So you were expected to come knowing this stuff?
Aha, he did. That's right. Yes, because actually it's one thing to listen. It's another thing to read and listen at the same time. And what Eller really wanted was his listeners to come prepared, not necessarily to have their heads buried in text during the music. He sent them out ahead of time, and people were supposed to do their homework, which, remember here that this is very much a piano culture. It's a world where people can easily trace those themes through on the piano. It's a world where you could expect that every single person that came to that concert could read music, as a norm. And so people were to do that, and they might well have piano duet arrangements of some of these pieces at home that they might try. The idea really being that they would use these notes to sort of stimulate their own understanding and curiosity, and then come to the concert and really get something out of it.
Of all the things we've talked about so far, that's the one that's probably in greatest contrast to today.
Right.
Because people do come late and leave early, although not to the extreme that you were talking about, or that they did then. You brought along some Mozart, which we're going to hear in just a moment. I need to mention to our listeners, first of all, that my guest on Live and Local is Christina Bashford, who teaches musicology at the University of Illinois, and also that our programs today are made possible with support from Columbia Street Roastery, roasting coffee daily at 24 East Columbia in Champaign, also offering a variety of tea and chai, open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 5:15 p.m., and Saturday mornings from 9 to noon. More information is available at 352-9713. Also, the other thing I need to remind our listeners of is that today is the last day, isn't it, of June, and that means it is the end of our fiscal year at WILL, as at so many other places, and that means further that the amount of money that we theoretically have in the bank at the end of today, or if you want to write us a check, postmark that check by today, is the amount we will have available to spend starting in the new fiscal year tomorrow, because we raise our money in order to pay for what's coming. We don't deficit spend at WYLL. And that means further that we do need your additional help. And if you haven't written that check and can do so and post date the check by today, then you will help us reach our goal of $2.1 million in membership support, which is pretty critical if we want to avoid additional cuts. And as we've rather publicly made some considerable cuts in the last number of months here at the stations. And as of sometime today, or at least as of yesterday's tally, we were still about $145,000 short of meeting that goal. So every contribution, no matter the amount, will bring us one step closer to meeting that. Of course, today is it. So if you can make that gift by sending in the check, better yet, if you can make it online, we will have the money instantly, and you can do that at willpledge.org, willpledge.org. If you prefer to mail the check, our address is WYLL, or I guess you can say Illinois Public Media, 300 North Goodwin in Urbana, Illinois, and the zip is 61801. And thanks very much. Christina, what prompted you to suggest we play some of the G major quartet of Mozart?
Simply, I suppose, as a sample of the sorts of things that people were listening to at the Musical Union, because the core repertoire that Ella was promoting was very much Haydn, Mozart, and Beethoven. I chose K387 and the G major quartet and the finale simply because I think it's quite a good one for us to imagine ourselves sitting around that string quartet and hearing the way in which Mozart passes the musical material around the quartet. The movement opens with a fugal section, so each instrument takes the theme in turn, and it's just, I think, quite a good way of trying to transport ourselves back there.
We're on the last movement of K387 of Mozart, the Emerson String Quartet. Imagine yourselves in the round around these guys.
Mm-hmm.
Eugene Drucker, Philip Setzer, Lawrence Dutton, and David Finkel, and you're listening on Live and Local. The difference is we haven't prepared you ahead of time with program notes.
Right.
So imagine that you know everything there is to know about this piece in advance of hearing it, which you're about to do on Live and Local. So you do get an idea of the back and forth of the theme, or passing around the circle, I guess, of the various, the main theme of this tune, and turning it upside down and taking it from major to minor key and other kinds of things, which, of course, you would have studied in advance and have known that this was going on, because you would have read John Ella's program notes if you were a member of the Musical Union and hearing this particular performance.
Indeed.
Of the G major quartet of Mozart, Kirchhoff 387 is the last movement we heard a good chunk of, performance here by the Emerson String Quartet. Who were the folks that Ella would get, and for that matter, the Beethoven Society, would get to play?
That's a good question. Actually, we haven't talked about that. This is before the era of the permanent string quartet ensemble, yeah, with a name, like the Joachim Quartet comes at the very end of the 19th century. So on the whole, these were scratch groups of players, people that Ella put together. I mean, he had regulars who he would often use, but particularly the lead violinist and the pianist would change from concert to concert. With Ella's enterprise, he brought in star players. So, gosh, the great and the good of Europe played for Ella. Clara Schumann, Anton Rubinstein, Charles Halle on violin. We had Wieniawski, we had Henri Vieuxtemps, we had Joachim himself. And on the cello, there was Alfredo Piatti. I mean, it was a real galaxy of players, because one thing Ella figured out very early on was that if you wanted people to appreciate good music, you had to give it to them played well.
And probably a lot of these people knew some of these performers.
Yes, and they, I mean, they were performers who were in town and were playing in other concerts in London, and obviously had big appeal. We use the term drawing power to indicate the prestige of a performer and the ability that performer had to bring in an audience. Because on top of subscribers, Ella would also sell tickets on the day, you know, to people who might want to come. And in a way, that was where the make or break on his concert series came. And he used to keep a notebook every concert of who the pianist was and who the first violinist was. And then he would indicate the number of ticket sales he got.
Really?
Yes. So I can tell you for sure that Anton Rubinstein brought in the most people of all.
So he was like the Vladimir Horowitz of his day, maybe. Mm-hmm.
And then Clara Schumann possibly in second place.
Yeah, she was quite...
Always playing Schumann's piano quintet.
Always?
Almost always, yeah.
Wow. You brought this rather interesting-looking book for me.
I did.
And I'll just tell listeners that this particular book fits in the palm of my hand.
Right.
Or it's about as big as the palm of my hand.
Yes, it is.
What is this book?
What is this book? It looks like a little prayer book or something of that sort. It's not, actually. What it is a miniature score. A miniature score of, I don't know which one I picked up, actually, but it's either Haydn, Mozart, or Beethoven.
Beethoven's quartets.
Beethoven's quartets, which were in circulation and being sold in London in the 1840s and 50s. I bought it because Ella also encouraged people to bring scores to concerts and to follow the music. In fact, he would probably much have preferred people to be following the music in score than to be reading a programme note. And, of course, score reading in a concert is something that perhaps today we would look at with slight amusement, perhaps even, or incredulity that people were bringing scores to concerts. But people did it a lot in the 19th century, and it wasn't considered a bad thing at all. In fact, it obviously was a sign of some sort of serious interest in the music, but a lot of people read scores during concerts.
And could read scores.
And could read scores, of course, yes. I mean, remember, again, it's this musically literate society we're dealing with.
Because now you'd have, I mean, today you have people who may be very knowledgeable about music, but not necessarily from reading it, just from hearing it.
Right, right. So whereas I think you could take for granted, Ella did, because his program notes even had these themes written in musical type, took for granted that everybody was musically literate.
We've been talking mostly about the musical union in the West End of London, 1830s and 40s, is that right?
It ran from 1845 to 1881.
Ah, okay. So a little later on.
Later.
And the Beethoven Society was
just 1840s, yeah.
1840s. And they played exclusively the music of Beethoven, but exclusively the string quartets of Beethoven.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And maybe were a little bit more snobbish about their Beethoven than Ella's group was about the rest of the music that was played. Fair enough? Or maybe more worshipful?
Maybe a little more worshipful. I mean, certainly Ella was keen to make people revere and, in a sense, worship the music. But it was a broader repertoire that he was dealing with. It was chamber music. It was music in general in many ways that he was trying to get people to engage with. Whereas the Beethovenites really were about deifying Beethoven as a sort of demigod and, you know, the person at the top of the mountain.
And was the person who organized the Beethoven Society concerts, did he have a particular agenda of behavior at his events?
Let me back up. The person who organized the Beethoven Quartet Society was a man called Thomas Alsager. He was actually a businessman, and he was the financial writer on the Times newspaper of London. He had an absolutely extraordinary interest in music, in chamber music, and an extraordinary reverence for Beethoven. He knew Mendelssohn. He was really well connected, was Alsager. I think the people he brought into his quartet society, to answer your question, were really devotees from the start. So the extent to which he really had to tell them how to behave, I'm not sure he really did. But he definitely wanted utmost silence. They say that the Beethoven Quartet Society concerts were held in the back room of Alsager's house. in a part of the house where street noise could not impinge.
Mm.
Yeah.
So even the setting itself was quieter than the norm.
Yeah, it was like the innermost recess. Yeah.
You had said earlier that the Quartet Society would sort of make a cycle of the quartets. Mm-hmm. Of all the quartets every year?
Every year, yeah, wow. All of them.
And including those at the very end, which still baffle us a bit today. You brought along a recording of Opus 130, one of his last ones.
Yeah, they certainly did baffle people. And I think they baffled many of the Beethoven devotees. But the thing about the Beethoven devotees was that they tended to think that even if they couldn't understand what they were hearing, it was by definition great because it was Beethoven. And if they couldn't understand, the fault was with them, not with Beethoven, if you follow my...
Well, you have some in your article. By the way, we're talking to Christina Bashford, who teaches musicology at the University of Illinois, about some norms of audience behaviors and some of the new audience behaviors encouraged by these particular chamber music societies in the West End of London in the 19th century. And you reprint here, I can hardly read this, one of the, you said that John Ella printed program notes that were fairly analytical or somewhat analytical, but here the ones of the Beethoven Society are rather worshipful. They have little quotations about Beethoven. Around flew each sweet sound, then darted to the sun. Slowly the sounds came back again, now mixed, now one by one, and now 'twas like all instruments, now like a lonely flute, and now it is an angel's song that makes the heavens be mute, referring always to Beethoven.
Always to Beethoven. So, the tack was different, yeah, and the printing of poetry or other quotations from literature was what Alsager did. In a sense, I think, with the Beethoven Quartet Society, the premise was, in a way, that devotion to Beethoven, by its very nature, implied comprehension, yeah, and maybe even... transcended it. I mean, maybe you didn't need to have Beethoven explained. Maybe you just needed to listen and immerse yourself emotionally in the music.
Let's find out. We have the tiniest movement, one of the tiniest movements of Beethoven. This is from his Opus 30 Quartet in B flat. The second movement, very fast, and a performance here by this is a British group, right? The Lindsays?
The Lindsay String Quartet, yeah.
I mean, nobody but a Brit would have the last name of Cropper, I think. Peter Cropper is the lead violinist here. And you're listening to Live and Local on FM 90.9. So now, if we're in the audience, probably, I mean, you could just hear that was kind of a piquant little, lively little movement. We're all going, applaud, 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 and somebody is bound to say...
Encore!
And so?
And so they play it again.
Applause. And might they have encored it again? We're not going to, but maybe.
I don't know. Maybe they did.
Maybe they did. If they really liked it. That was the Lindsays playing the very short second movement, which follows the very long first movement of the Beethoven String Quartet in B-flat, Opus 130. My guest on Live and Local today is Christina Bashford. And We have just a few minutes left. Coming up at 101, it's the Writer's Almanac with Garrison Keillor, and more classical music for you at 106. We have support for today's broadcast from the Community Blood Services of Illinois, providing all donated blood for patients in Champaign-Urbana, Charleston, Mattoon, Danville, and Effingham. Blood donation takes only 45 minutes and saves lives. Donation information is at 367-2202. And we have support today from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held every Saturday from 2 to 6. Information is available at 337-7704 or at thecorkscrew.com. I will mention a couple of performances you can go see and hear in our area. Tonight, it's the weekly traditional Irish music session at Bentley's Pub downtown Champaign. That starts at 7 o'clock. In Decatur, the Decatur Young Park Singers are at Lincoln Park tonight at 7 o'clock. In Urbana, the Chip McNeil Quintet is playing at the Iron Post tonight at 7. Bossa Nuevo play tonight at Victory Park in Urbana at 6:30. Christina, thank you very much for joining me on the show today.
Thank you. It's been fun.
We've played music by Haydn, Mozart, and Beethoven. These were chamber music societies in the West End of London. Did they ever actually play British music?
That's the big question, isn't it? And the answer is yes, they did, though not in large quantities. But there was quite a lot of British chamber music being written at this time. Unfortunately, not that much of it survives because not much of it was published, and we don't have many manuscript sources for a lot of it. But some of it does, and some of it is very fine. And the piece I chose to bring along today to illustrate this is a piano sextet written by William Sterndale Bennett, perhaps Britain's finest composer of the early 19th century, someone whom Mendelssohn and Schumann admired particularly. Bennett went to study in Leipzig. This piece is the piano sextet, written, I think, in the middle of the 1830s, before he went to Leipzig, before he met Mendelssohn and Schumann. It's for piano, two violins, viola, cello, and double bass. So the scoring is quite extraordinary, and it's really quite an interesting piece.
And we are hearing a Hungarian ensemble, I believe.
Performing it, yes.
With a number of names that I'm going to find difficult to pronounce, mm-hmm. Therefore I'm not going to do that. And we will say goodbye and thanks, mm-hmm. And we'll have to do this again. Second movement of William Sterndale Bennett's sextet. Just a bit of it before we go out on Live and Local.